Welcome to Podcastville. The Church of What's Happened Now is brought to you by FujiSports.com. If you're looking for a geese, chin fucking straps, a mat, a fucking belt, a mouthpiece, anything MMA related, if you want quality, it starts with Fuji Sports. I'm a fat fuck. I'm always in somebody's clothes guard. They're pulling, they're tugging on my sleeve, on my neck. They can't rip it down. Listen, tough, durable, and quality, and the price is in your fucking range. Prices start at fucking like $69. I get you a purple gi that rocks, that's light, for $99, $98, and they go all the way up to $130 for the Superado, which is a light type competition gi. They got the Psycho, the Psycho, they got the Superito, they got the Basic, and then they got the new competition gi. They got the Element. Listen, if you're looking for a gi, shin pad, Fuji, they are fucking Japan. They started the whole fucking program. Go to FujiSports.com right now and press in.
Church.
Bam! And get the motherfucking party started. Get 10% off. Who the fuck is bothering me? Get 10% off delivered to your house. Number two, if you're looking for supplements, you got to go with Onnit. Whether it's the Shroom Tech, Shroom Tech Sport, Shroom Tech Immune, the protein powder, whatever the fuck you're looking for, I got it. Onnit's got it. Go to Onnit.com right now and press in.
Church.
Boom! And get 10 motherfucking percent off. Kick this fucking muley. There you go. Wednesday the 17th. Providence, get ready. I'm opening up that ass tomorrow night. We're coming in deep. Me and Matt Fultron ain't fucking around. The Church of What's Happening Now, cocksuckers. One of my all-time favorite jams. Josh Wolf, the Christ Killer, himself, Lee Syatt, a.k.a. Johnny Belinda.
Sand rains down in here, I said.
Drop it. Good as it gets, brother.
That's great.
Before the fucking podcast started, we're talking about Sinatra.
Yeah.
And how strong he was. Mm-hmm. And, like, you can't, through protocol, like where he's from, where I'm from, you can't go up to a guy like that. And, like, and there's a great scene in that close range with Christopher Walken and Sean Penn, where Christopher Walken tells Sean Penn, as his father, you can come with me a couple times. And if you like it, you're in. And one day he's sitting with the whole family, the whole five brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And Sean Penn walks in with his girlfriend. They're underage. They sit at the fucking table. And the girl goes, by the way, he wants in.
Mm.
He wants to join you guys. We're getting an apartment in the car, and he wants to join you guys. And they all broke into fucking laughter right in his face. And they all got up and walked out of the room. And Christopher Walken says, don't you ever fucking do something. He told the girl to get the fuck out of the room. And he goes, don't you ever talk to me like that. That's the protocol I grew up with.
Right.
You can't approach a guy, you know, like people call you here and say shit to you and like Facebook you. That's not the protocol.
Yeah.
You can't go directly to somebody. You have to have a way around or something. So we're just talking about like Sinatra's mentality at that point. The thing I liked about it was...
You're talking about the Tonight Show thing.
The Tonight Show thing with Mickey Rickles, Don Rickles.
Yeah.
Just all the story. Remember, I grew up in North Bergen, which is the people from Hoboken who moved on up.
Yeah.
Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah,
to you?
Yeah.
I learned a lot about who I was when the Sinatra documentary came out on HBO, because it spoke about Sinatra, how he wasn't allowed above 9th Street. When he was a kid, the Irish would beat you the fuck up. They were oppressed by the Irish. Mm-hmm. So those Italians moved out. And it's really weird that I grew up with a weird mentality. Like I think about my life and I think about my mind and why I think like that. When I watch that Tonight Show thing, I listen to Sinatra's voice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's everybody's voice. It's Hudson County. There's something about a Hudson County. Like the people I grew up with, their parents all had Sinatra stories.
Yeah, but the best part of that
Rickles coming out is that Rickles cut through all that. He just walked right up, you know.
Oh, no, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
And then he delivered the goods.
Yeah. And Sinatra loved it. Loved it.
Well, Sinatra had a sense of humor.
That's what I'm saying. My favorite part about him was that even though he was Frank Sinatra, you know, he let Rickles take the piss out of him. They all poked fun out of him. They all poked fun of him. And he laughed because he had so much confidence in it that he was like, it doesn't matter what you fucking say, I'm Frank Sinatra.
Bro, when he calls him over and he goes, excuse us for a second. Marco Macanango got two bullets to the head. Like, you could get shot for saying something like that to somebody in public. Like, you get shot. Like, why are you saying this to me?
But those guys that really didn't fucking...
They didn't. He didn't. We were talking about the Elvis documentary and then how Sinatra ran in. Like, that story about on Sunset when he went into the restaurant.
What?
And he fucking, he was eating at a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And the busboy was Spanish. And he dropped a tray of glasses and all the glasses broke. And he owner berated the kid and fired him. And Sinatra went up to him and said, how much for each fucking glass? And the guy's like, what are you talking about? He goes, how much for the glasses? He goes, I don't know, they're $1 a piece. He gave him the money. And he goes, next time I come here, that kid better work here. Or I'm going to tell all my friends not to fucking come here. Don't talk to a kid like that. Yeah, dog. Like, he was... You know,
but listen, without him, there's no Sammy Davis Jr.
No, this is what
because
I'm
nobody wanted to see a black entertainer like that.
No, this is it.
Yeah, Sinatra, you know what I mean.
Sinatra said,
"Fuck you, he's with me."
You know,
as soon as he said he's with me, the whole country was like, "All right, we like that black
guy." That's it. That was
amazing.
It was that simple that this country was all. Dog, I remember going to my friend's house and eating there one night, and the mother was like going on and on about. I remember one time for $2. We saw Sinatra, this guy, that guy. And my friend goes, and Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Bunch. And she just froze. Like, but those were the stories I grew up with and all the little personality traits. In 98, I read a script that was called The Jimmy Roselli Story. My manager called me and he goes, the casting
Who was your manager? Who were you with back then?
Jeff? Jeff Gatlin called me and he goes, I have a script for you to read. I sold you on the casting director. And what it was the guy that did Drugstore Cowboy.
Mm-hmm.
It was his movie. And it was starring John Travolta. And they were looking for a comedian. And I read the script. And it was interesting because I had heard the story before. And the story was that there was a guy that was better than Sinatra. Sinatra will tell you.
Mm-hmm.
Sinatra will tell you that the guy was better than him. His name was Jimmy Roselli. And Jimmy Roselli was from Hoboken, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And Sinatra hired him to sing at his mother's birthday. And Roselli didn't show up. So it was a sign of disrespect. So Roselli told anybody who gives him work, I don't do work for.
Well, Sinatra told people.
Sinatra laid the fucking groundwork out and banned him. The fucking guy's record label fired him, everything. The guy would have to tape albums and sell them out of the trunk of his car. He was the original MC Hammer.
Come on.
And the Italians would go, Jimmy, close the fucking trunk. You're embarrassing us. Come over here. We'll give you the $10. You're going to sit there and sell fucking albums. So what he had to do was go on the road with comics.
Oh.
So he would open up for comics and sing a song, and then the comics would go up. So it was very vaudevillian. So when I read the script, I read the script, and it was down to two comics, me and everybody loves Molly.
Billy Gardell.
Billy Gardell.
Yeah, yeah.
They liked us so much that they said, fuck it. We're just going to hire both of yous. That was the audition that I snorted coke till 6:15 in the morning. And at 10, I had to go in there. When I got in the room, Travolta was in the room. Like, it was real. Like, once you got to the audition, Travolta, callback.
Was this before or after basketball?
This was after basketball. This is when I was getting my shit together. It was about 2000, to be honest with you. I was getting my shit together, and I got done. I was going to acting class, and I got that script, and I had to go across from the Burger King on Western. That's a bad fucking neighborhood.
Yeah, I know where that is.
There's a little office in there that's all tip-top magoo. They gave you water like a white person. They validated your parking.
You didn't
even know it was there. And that's where the director from... Drugstore Cowboy.
Who is that? That's not Fincher, right?
No. I forget what his name is. And Travolta were in the callback, bro. The cocaine high evaporated when I walked in, like that residual feeling you get, like that you even drink orange juice.
Gus Van Sant.
Gus Van Sant. All the orange juice. Then he took an extra step and came and watched me at the store, Gus Van Sant. So they were in. They were in. My manager goes, go to Florida, have a great time. By the time you come back, you'll start shooting. First day in Florida, the phone rings. Travolta backed out to do the Scientology movie.
Oh, the Battlestar Galactica?
Battlestar Galactica.
Bad move on his part.
And the Jimmy Roselli story went fucking unfucking heard.
Can I tell you something? It's kind of probably the way, you know, considering how his life went, I'm not surprised that's what happened to the movie. You know what I mean? Like, he was going to be big again, and then all of a sudden he's not. And now, where is he now?
Who, Travolta?
No, whatever. Like, what happened to, I know he's probably dead, but what happened to Jimmy Roselli?
He's probably dead.
I mean, but what happened to his career? He did nothing? Nothing.
I don't know what the whole story, how it ended up. I forget, to be honest with you. I forget how the script ended up and what happened to him. Type in Jimmy Roselli.
Dude, you know when the first time I met Billy Gardell? It was when I was running that room at the Union. Remember that room? It was right that one of my favorite rooms ever, because it was, I like small rooms.
It was perfect.
They get hot and they get loud.
It was perfect.
I have still, to this day, I think I've told you this before, but I've never, the most I've ever seen anyone murder a room is Rogan in that room.
Rogan did the best out of his life.
In that room. Because it was so small and it was like packed.
And Stanhope had a good set in there.
Oh, a bunch.
He talked about stepping on his mother's pussy. It was a spider.
That was also the first time I heard his joke, which is still one of my favorite jokes ever, which is, you know, I told my girlfriend I wanted a titty fucker, and she said, how are you going to make that feel good for me? And I said, I'll tell you what, right when I'm about to come, I'll stop punching you in the face.
That was
But the first time I met Billy Gardell was in that room. Rogan was buddies with him and had brought him from the East Coast, or I don't know if they're still buddies, but they were buddies. And Billy was wearing those Cab Calloway white and black dress shoes that he used to wear fucking everywhere. And Joe was like, can my buddy get up? I'm like, yeah, whatever. But he was dressed like, you know, he always had a suit and that fucking, he was, Billy Gardell used to dress it up, you know? In those shoes,
he looked like Biggie.
Yeah,
he would walk into a room looking like Biggie.
Yeah, absolutely.
I see him from time to time. He's still a sweetheart.
He's a great guy.
He's a great guy.
Yeah,
I see. I bumped into him where he has cars and shit.
Yeah,
fucking, he's a sweetheart. And when you bump into him right in Burbank,
yeah, I always there's one coffee shop I always run into him here in the Valley. That Union, man, was that room was like a little bar room. You know, the difference between like a little, when you do a one-nighter, like the difference between those big stages.
How long have you been doing stand-up?
Well, the very first time I did it, I was 15, right? And then, you know, I did it once, maybe again in high school. And then I did a comedy competition the next time I got on stage in San Antonio. And the fourth time I was ever on stage, I opened for Sam Kinison. So I was like, oh, this comedy shit is easy. You know what I mean? Like, I've been on stage four times and I'm opening for Kinison. Because I've told you this story, right? So, but yeah, and then I took a lot of time off here in town, which I regret. In the time that I took off, if I'm being honest with you, when I was writing on shows, when I was writing on Yes Dear and writing on staff, and when I was writing for a little bit on Chelsea, I didn't get on stage because my deal with Beth was I'm gone enough. I'm not going to be gone all. If I wrote on a show, then I had to put stand up to the side because I couldn't write during the day and go out there at night. Do you know what I mean? I had to have a little life work balance. And so I took a bunch of time off from stand up, and I really regret that, because right now on the road, I'm like, oh, that's right. And finally, because about a year and a half ago, man, there was a huge switch for me. I finally accepted what I do well. I always kind of knew what I do well, but I always fought against it a little bit. And about a year and a half ago, I finally accepted it and was like, this is just the comic you are, man. You can't try to be a different person anymore. And it changed the entire thing. my comedy was always okay in my brain. People always had a good time. But the last year and a half or so, it's been a different beast because I'm truly just being myself and having a good time on stage. And it's changed everything.
An issue of time. How, like, time. Time is so fucking stand-up-ish. Like, it's such a cliche thing to say, but it's just like anything else. It's time.
Yeah?
It's time. Like, when you think it, when you're doing comedy 9 years, you in the back of your head, you think you have it figured out.
Yeah.
But it's not even close. Mm-mm. And it's weird. I was doing comedy about 9 years, 10 years, and I remember thinking, I don't know what the fuck I was thinking. I just knew that I thought I was on the right path with whatever I was doing. I was a regular at the store, and I saw Paul Rodriguez killing. And I walked into the main room, and he sucked me in, and I walked in, and Mitzi was sitting in the thing, and she goes, sit here. And like, I'm watching, going, wow, this is magical shit. Mm-hmm. And she goes, you see what happens at 20 years? And I remember thinking, fuck, I got to do this 10 more fucking years. What the fuck? It's 2001 or something. And you're telling me I got to do this 10 more fucking years to get that good? And then I remember being in the game about 16 years, and I wasn't really in love with it anymore. Like, I just didn't see a purpose for it anymore. Yeah. The realities were setting in my mind. The realities were setting in. I was out here. I had shot movies. I had done TV shows. And it just wasn't going my way. That's it. There was no excuse. I had given it everything I had. About like 2006, I was really fucking sick. Like, I got blown smoke up my ass, you know? Mm-hmm. And I bought it. It was what I wanted to hear. So the addiction got worse because things weren't happening. I thought the phone was going to ring off the hook. I did everything I was supposed to fucking do. And I said, fuck this. I'm not going to wallow. I'm going to go to the improv every Thursday and not tell nothing to nobody. Walk in the side, watch the headliner. And I did that for about 12 weeks. I just went down there. I didn't say nothing to nobody. I watched Greg Giraldo. I watched Ralphie. I watched, I think it was Bill Burr. I watched just whoever was cracking at that time. And I was like, bro, I am the farthest thing from that. Like, I really am the farthest thing from that. That I'm not a headliner. At the 16-year mark, I was like, at the 15-year mark, I was like, I'm not a headliner. Mm-hmm. It's just never going to work. This just, I remember going out after The Longest Yard and just eating dick. Like, people coming to see me because of the movie and me just eating a bag of dicks and thinking, fuck, I've been doing this now for 14 years.
Can I tell you, the people who first, when Chelsea first hit and we were headlining clubs or going and doing theaters, the people who first saw me then, I apologize. I mean, I thought in that moment, this is it.
So weird.
But it's a different. Listen, I learned a lot from watching you, dude, because what I learned from watching you is that at some point you just said, fuck it, this is who I am, and I'm going to ride or die with who I am. With who I am. How many people, when you first got to town, told you to clean, not to swear, and how many people?
Not to swear, to sell your show on TV, to make your image likable, to make your image so they could write a TV show against about
everybody.
It was just something that was,
but you
it
were
was disturbing.
Yeah. Listen, you know, when we first started, I remember your jokes were terrible, but when you got mad and you were you on stage, you ripped that place up. And I mean, both of us, we were obviously young comics at the time, but we should have picked up to the fact, oh, when he's being himself, he's tearing this place down. But when we were writing jokes, it was dick.
Dick.
It was dick. That's dick. Right? So what I learned, you were just like, and so what happened to you doesn't happen to most people, hitting you after 50, right?
After 20 years of, I remember going to Columbus the first time as a headliner and just dying a slow death. This had to be when I first signed with Justin. First time Justin called me, I think he gave me Cobbs and something else just to see if we liked each other, how this thing worked. Mm-hmm. I think Portland Helium is when we had our first disagreement about something.
How deep into the podcast were you at that time?
Maybe a year and a half into the podcast. Once, when I was doing Beauty and the Beast, I was about 100 people a show.
Mm-hmm.
100 people showing up going, hey, we listen to Beauty and the Beast, you know, so that was the very beginning. I still remember doing Cobbs and selling out with Felicia and going, we're on to something. Mm-hmm. This is fucking crazy. We're on to something, you know. But my stand-up wasn't.
No.
No, not at all. It was not ready at all.
But here's another thing that, so for me, again, watching you, I know there are things that we're naturally good at, right? You are naturally gifted at commanding the stage, storytelling, charisma that allows you to say things that other people can't get away with. Yes? One of the things that has not always been your strength is to sit and write. But the fact that you make yourself do that, you've turned yourself into a writer. Like, it's amazing. Like, the writing jokes is not easy, and then the discipline to do it is also not easy.
You give yourself, listen, we've been here.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk the particulars. You're in the major leagues. Last week, something happened that was kind of weird. Okay, a fighter, one of my favorite fighters, I love her to death, came in 7 pounds over. Now, we don't know what the strategy is. Some people have speculation that's what she wanted, you know. You only lose 30% of your purse. You're not making any money anyway.
That's a lot of percentage,
though. That's a lot of percentage, but you get not the guaranteed win.
Yeah.
And let the UFC tell you to go down. But at the end of the week.
7 pounds is a lot.
7 pounds is a lot.
That means you weren't trying.
It was a joke, and you know, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And she's beautiful, and I love her jiu-jitsu. Her jiu-jitsu is money. I watch her roll in her fucking money. I watch her against Gabby Garcia with no gi. Gabby Garcia is a girl that's bigger than me.
Yeah.
You have to see this woman. And Mackenzie Dern rolls with her and shit and ADCC and all this shit. So I really like her. But at the end of the day, after all the jokes are told, let's be honest, you're in the UFC. You came in 7 pounds overweight in the biggest forum there is for fighting in the world. Now let's talk about stand-up in that sense. Right now, we're at the Comedy Store. Right now, we have the podcast. Right now, there's so many things going on. I cannot get away with what I was getting away with 10 years ago. People will not come see me. If I just go up there high and try to improvise and be cute, he was good, but not good enough mm-hmm. to come back and watch. I didn't see anything. You know, each show, you try to be different. Every week, you try to write. You can't sell a $10,000 car wearing $10 shoes.
Nope.
That's it. I always go back to that because at the end of the week, we're fucking salesmen. You cannot sell a $10,000 car with $10 shoes on. How am I going to buy a car from you, a BMW, when your shoes are unshined?
Mm-hmm.
I went to my agent the other day. I saw a kid. His pants were so fucking high. If he was my agent, I'd smack him in the face. His pants were 4 inches over his fucking thing.
That's how they're wearing them, dude.
I was ready to say, invite your pants down and have a party like that old stupid shit. You know, just certain things that I'm happy that a big agency didn't approach me 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I'm fucking ecstatic that a big manager didn't approach me 10 years ago because I would have fucked it up.
Joe, the reason, you know, when I had those TV deals early on, if I'm honest with myself, I'm the reason they didn't go because I had everybody else they were giving TV deals to. Think about the people who were on the air. Roseanne, Tim Allen, Paul Reiser, Seinfeld. They had Drew Carey, a huge pool of material for their character. They've been doing stand-up for a long time. They had a huge backbone, right, of what their writers could rely on. I was given a show just because of my situation, not because of my comedy. You know what I'm saying? So the situation was interesting to the networks, but my there was no stand-up-wise, I wasn't close to ready. So when they were like, oh, like, let's take a look at the situation. Single guy raising 3 kids in 1 room. Perfect. We love it. And then when they went to my comedy to help write the scripts, there wasn't any. And it died. It died because I wasn't ready for what they were giving me. Do you know what I mean? And the same thing with stand-up. Like right now, I feel like if you come to my show and you and you're and you're a fan of mine, you come to my show, you know what my shows are like, you're gonna have a good fucking time. Look, man, you know, I made a decision about a year and a half, 2 years ago, that one of the reasons I had not done it was because of the people in this town that I respect so much. You know, how many times did you say, hey, go back on the road, hey, put down that little fucking banjo? And I'd be like, yeah, maybe I shouldn't. But at the end of the day, I do 50 minutes of stand-up, which is basically like three long stories, and then I end the show with three songs because I like it. And about a year and a half ago, I was like, fuck it. This is something I like to do. And I don't attack jokes like you do. And that's what I mean. Like, I had to accept who I was. I tried to attack jokes like you or Rogan or Burr because you were the guys that I respect. And you were the guys that make me laugh. And then I had to realize I'm a little sillier than that. You know what I mean? And I just had to accept the fact that that's just fucking who
I
am.
That's the art.
Yeah.
That's the art.
Yeah.
The art has no boundaries.
Right.
The art just expects you to be funny. How you get there is your fucking journey.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
How you get there is how you hang that TV up on the wall. It's up to you.
But it took.
I really don't give a fuck how you hang it up as long as you hang it up. You want to hang it with hangers and a Chinese wire? Go ahead. I'm telling you to use this fucking thing and it'll be fine. You want to use fucking hangers
and a
Chinese wire, then this is what you get.
Yeah, but it took me because. When you are in business with people that you respect and you admire, you can't help but want them to be like, oh, I think he's funny too. And at some point I had to be like, fuck that. I'm not performing for them. You know what I mean? It'd be nice, but I'm not performing for them.
You know what I learned early on? I saw people give up their thing for stand-up, and I didn't like it.
Give up their what?
Who they are.
Yeah.
For the sake of the town. I figured it out this way. I did movies, I did TV shows, and I was an okay stand-up, but there was still something missing. I knew there was still something missing. I knew that, you know what? Yeah, I have success there. That's where the strength comes from, is putting down the ego. What you just said is a beautiful thing about why the shows didn't get picked up. A lot of comics, 10 years ago, you weren't saying that. Mm-hmm. You were saying something completely different.
Oh, 10 years ago, there was some people angry. I was blaming. Yeah,
you were blaming. You see this in your journey. You learn all these things in your whatever journey you choose, whether it's a dentist, a lawyer, a doctor, a stand-up, they're all the fucking same journey. You're going to feel different about it when you did 20 years in, then 10 years in, then 5 years in, then 6 months in. It's that you stuck with it, and that's how you really fucking learn. Like now I know, like, listen, I'm 55, and I'm a fucking black belt in jiu-jitsu. I'm a black belt in jiu-jitsu. I'm a black belt in stand-up with a couple red stripes.
Yep.
And you got to add the life aspect to it. Like, I seen prison. I seen people getting stabbed. I've also seen a woman give birth twice, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a guy raise three kids by himself with no mom. I saw some shitty shit, but I also saw some beautiful shit. My range to draw from. You want to get down, we can get down. I could talk about putting a bottle in some chick's pussy and blood came out in the bottle and I fainted. Or I could talk about fucking, you know.
You ever heard that one yet?
Yeah. The stripper in Seattle, I put the fucking wine cooler in her monkey and I fucking tried to masturbate and it popped a fucking period and I fainted and shit, you know. You know, we could talk. There's so much diversity to talk from.
Yeah.
Going to prison, you know. I never even got into you like when I got out of fucking prison and I tried to go back to college and they wouldn't let me.
Oh,
and
shit.
I had to fight. And then I had to take them to court to be allowed to go to night classes so I'd get my degree. And after I beat them, I took 3 credits and I go, you know what? What am I gonna fucking get a degree for?
Yeah.
Like, I had all these fucking trials and tribulations because. At 25, I had what I wanted. I had a wife, a kid, and a job. And I was going to school, and I was making a little bit of money. And I go, if this is what life is, shoot me now.
Yeah?
Like, shoot me now.
Yeah.
This is it. 5 days a week I work. Saturdays I watch the kid. And Sunday I go to her parents and watch the Buffalo Bill game. Shoot me now. And when I'm 65, I got a gold watch and happy retirement. Shoot me now. Shoot me now. Mm-hmm. I can't. Don't tell me this was what I fucking went for all these years. I was snorting coke. I was having a good time. I was breaking into people's houses. I was having a great time by myself. And now I'm sitting here watching TV with a woman telling me, no, I couldn't do it at 25.
You know what is somebody said to me recently that I had never thought of? Because I know how you grew up. And they said that poor people have dreams. Rich kids don't have dreams. Why do they get everything they want? Because we were talking about entertainment people, and I go, most entertainment people I know grew up kind of on the lower end of the money scale. The guy was like, yeah, because poor people have dreams, and they don't let go of those dreams because they're always in their head at a young age dreaming of a way out, dreaming of something better. And that, I'm the same fucking way, right? We're always... That would never work for you because you always dreamt of something better, of a different life.
I just dreamt of not sleeping on a couch.
Yeah, dude.
Being able not to go to work. I did not want any money. Like, I just wanted enough money that I could go outside and get a soda in the daytime and a paper, maybe a salami sandwich from Stan's up at the corner. And I was good. Like, I was lazy. I didn't want to... Listen, I just needed existence. I still remember going to see a counselor before you leave prison, and they go, you know, I don't know if you know this, you could file for Social Security. You're a felon. You're disabled. And I was like, so how much geese are we talking about? And they were like, it's like $600 a month or something. They'll help you. They'll pay for an apartment for you. And I was like, I was almost in. Like, if it was $1,200 a month and rent free in a shit apartment, that would have been my life, Josh. I ain't gonna lie to nobody. I love movies. I love TV. You know, I love smoking pot. If I could have figured out a way, that was just a time in my life where I just wanted to be left alone, a little shitty apartment. In Boulder, I paid $400 for a fucking one bedroom. It was the little, now that same thing is $1,600, $1,800, that apartment. But the point being is I didn't need much. I was pretty, all I wanted to do, and if I could snort coke, 3 nights a week, that even made it the better. I don't want to do nothing. But then I would go to Subway's and I would go to different restaurants and I would see those old dudes with the ponytail.
Yeah.
With the shirt of Molly Hatchet, Spring 83 tour. And the other kids are like Jacob's age and they're telling him, so you really saw Led Zeppelin? He's like, yeah, man. I looked at that guy and I go, that's who I'm going to be, and that can't happen either.
Yeah.
I never wanted to be the cool guy like that. That's, so I got to find the happy medium. And then I went after everything I thought, you know, oh my God, I could. I tried to get the best jobs with the felony, with a GED and no college education. Like, I was already getting interviews for places like that, for selling pharmaceuticals starting at $60,000. Like, I was bullshitting my way in those doors.
Yeah.
Like, I was that good at bullshitting my way in those doors. But then that comic thing kept coming back. Like, I would watch a movie and go, fuck, I gotta figure out how to do comedy.
But what was it about comedy?
In the movie that made me lose my mind, the first movie I saw that I left there going was Splash.
Yeah, but that wasn't stand-up.
That was 84. Still, I didn't know what the route was. I just wanted to be able to do what John Candy was doing. I was like, damn, I got to figure out how to do what John Candy's doing. And then that's 84.
Yeah.
And 87, I got locked up. And right about that time, two weeks before I kidnapped that dude. 2 weeks before that went down. This is how life works. I got into an argument with a guy named Grant. On the lot. I thought about how hard about this name. His name was Grant. And he was a white dude and he was fucking built. And in one of my cocaine tirades the next morning, I went off on him about a customer. And we went neck to neck. We were going to punch the shit out of each other. A manager came out, broke us up.
Where are you working at the time?
I was working at Bill Crouch Subaru. And they said, listen, just stay at the opposite side of the stores for a couple of weeks and don't talk to them and you don't talk to them. And we said everything we had to say to each other. We had said everything we had to say. We both called each other faggots and fuck you and you.
Yeah.
You punch me first and I'll punch you first. So it was cool. We went to manager's meetings the following week. And you know, like a week later, I was standing on the opposite side of the store and he came up to me and he goes, hey man, I know you don't like me. But he goes, you know what I did for the last 20 years? I was in entertainment in Las Vegas. And I'm just looking at this dude. Mm-hmm. Like, what are you getting to? Like, what the fuck are you talking about? I was just thinking about going home and doing a line of coke or who I was going to fucking, you know, whatever that night.
Yeah.
And he goes, you have a career in stand-up comedy. He goes, I've seen all of them. And I can tell that you're a stand-up comic. And I go, like, that's great. And I just went on with my business. And then when I got locked up and I started doing those shows on Thursday nights, yeah. I was like, Grant might have a point. Everything just pointed to it. The door was right there. And then I came out and got a job and it was all forgotten. I'm like, well, what am I thinking? That's like becoming a Christian in jail. When you yeah. come out, you throw the book up in the air. You know what I'm saying? It was like that. Like in prison for a while, I was writing jokes. There was no resources. There was no internet.
Right.
You know, I didn't know about Judy Carter. I didn't know about nothing. I just was just writing on a notebook about black people. You know, love lizards, and, you know, white people. I didn't fucking know because I was in prison.
Yeah.
So that was my whole shtick, was white people, bikers, black people, and fucking the Italian fat cook. That's it. That was my material, so I had to work with. So once I got out of prison, I was like, I ain't no stand-up. That was just a pipe dream.
Do you remember? I remember the first joke I told on that comedy, and I was thinking about this because I ran over an old flyer of a show me, you, and Brody did in Seattle years ago, right? When I started thinking about, oh, what time was that? What jokes was I telling? And then I actually found an old notebook. And I remember the first joke I ever told on the Comedy Underground stage was this. Was that I was poor. And so I had gone to the sperm bank to see about donating the sperm bank. And there was, I was surprised to know that you had to apply. And I was even more surprised to find out that they accept less than 6% of their applicants. Six, which means it's hard, statistically harder to get into the sperm bank than it is into Harvard Law School. And you know what that means? That means that there's a lot of picky fucking lesbians. That was my first joke I ever told on that stage. And I remember thinking, that's the smartest joke I'll ever write. You know what I mean? You know that first one where you're like, oh, this is the best joke ever. I'm expecting like a, just booed. Nothing, dude.
You know what's really weird? Because it seems like whenever you start, because I had one, like everyone has one with like a stat in it, and everyone has like something based on a song.
Sure,
like
yeah.
Based on lyrics. It's funny, like, because that. Like whenever I go up, I'm like, oh, this person is new. They're doing something based that. Oh, I looked this up, and there's 80%. I'm like, so there's a percentage point in it. That means you're new. I don't know what it is about
because the stat tells you that they're trying to seem like they're smart comics. So I'm gonna do a little research on the interwebs and find out that 8%. Like, and it doesn't mean shit. But that underground, those open mics. Some of my best memories in
California. I told Lee that I still remember getting there on a Friday night. And then that was the first thing I said to that crazy bitch. I go, show me this club you saw.
Yeah.
And we took a car ride and we walked around. And then I went there and I remember looking in the window. It was a bar. And I'm like I was there. Like, oh yeah. My God, this is the Comedy Underground. The fucking figure with the heat in the building and shit. Yeah. I was like, oh my God, this is different. I went right down there that night and you walked in and you're from Boston. I go, perfect. I'm one guy from the East Coast. At least I got an ally.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. It was like, I remember starting first, like the first couple open mics, you go from one, then maybe you move to number two.
Yeah.
Then you go to number four. And then by the end, I was number 15. I was just closing it out. And that fucking feels great.
It really did,
it
man.
Really felt like just the pecking order of, you know, I sit here now. Like today, I just announced that the Netflix thing. Listen, this is a blue collar mentality. Like the way I did comedy was blue collar. I did it blue collar the whole way. I just went back to the basic rules. Just keep getting on stage. They're going to throw tomatoes at you, and eventually they won't throw tomatoes. You know, you go on mm-hmm. stage with a fireman's helmet on. You know, they're throwing shit on you. And I knew. I didn't have nothing else to do. Where else was I going to... What the fuck was I going to do here
yeah, but,
in 2007? You think I was really just going to quit stand-up
and get a job
selling cars? No. Like, that's what I was planning.
No.
In 2010, I went over to that Ford store. How fucking crazy is that? In 2010, I went over there for 3 interviews, got the job, and they wanted me to go piss in a bottle. And I pulled the guy over, and I go, that's not going to work. And he goes, what are you talking about? I go, smoke dope with 3 hands. He goes, well, you got to stop.
Yeah.
I go, that's not going to work. Let me give some shout-outs here. Hold on. I want to give a shout-out to Catherine Preet, Meg Toussaint, Lou Russ X, Eric Sean, James Diaz, Jeff Slaughter, Paul Lynch, and Patio Furniture, you badass bitch. I don't even rhyme, but let me do a bun just to get the party started. Yeah, when I was telling Lydia today how you go to an open mic, and at first you're number one on the list.
Yeah.
You take the bullet of death. You do that like 3 weeks in a row. And what saved us was that we had a mentor
at
the mics. Like, that was big. Like, that was big.
But
like,
he cared, Joey. He, Carl, genuinely cared, not just about where he worked and the Comedy Underground. Carl cared about comedy. He fucking loved comedy. So as goofy as he was, he wanted to make sure that was a good show. And if he didn't think you were doing something right in his way, he would tell you.
Bro, he had such an influence on me.
Yeah.
I think about it now, like the first person who influenced me was him. Like, he pulled me aside and said, do this joke here. You're insulting people. Do this here.
Yeah.
And then he did something to me one night. He made me follow Rick Dukeman. And I went up there. I don't know this fucking guy. And that's why it's better not to know who to follow. Like, I learned a big lesson that day. You don't need to know who anybody is. Just go up there and do your material. It doesn't matter who goes in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I became friends with Rick Dukeman. Because I followed him at an open mic. He was working on some HBO stuff.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, like, I'm working on some HBO stuff. And I didn't know who the fuck he was, and I didn't give a fuck.
Yep.
I just come home from fighting with Carol, that dirty whore. You know what I'm saying? I don't give a fuck about who Rick Dukeman is or whatever.
Yeah.
And I went up there and followed him, and I had a good set. And he came up to me afterward. He goes, not a lot of people could have followed me. That's pretty good. Stick with it. And then when I got here, I called him for a lot of counseling. Him and his wife were fucking brilliant. They knew exactly. They're like, just keep calling him for spots. You're doing the right thing. He goes, I would go down to the improv after the show was done and buy drinks for people and put spotlights on in the back and do it. It's all about what you want. I thought, and then his wife invited me over for dinner one night.
Yeah.
And she was telling me how he did Letterman. And the next day they drove from New York to where she's from in Ohio. And they drove all night and got there like at 8 in the morning. And at 5 o'clock, they ate dinner and he was putting his shoes on. She goes, where are you going? He goes, there's an open mic down the corner at the pizza place. I'm going to go do it. She goes, you just did Letterman. He goes, exactly. That was yesterday.
Yeah.
And he goes, that's your mentality. That's.
But it has to be.
That has to be your mentality.
There was a kid that was opening up for me, and I forget which city it was. He was hosting, right? I forget which city it was. But I asked him because he was pretty funny. And I said, you want to do this full time? And he goes, yeah. I go, how many nights are you getting on stage a week? And he said, I do 3 sets a week. I go, well, you should quit. I said, quit. And he said, why? I said, you know, look, I'm going to give you an example. Like, say Joe Rogan is in LA for a week and he's doing stand-up. He'll do 3 sets sometimes in a night. And if one of the best guys in the world is sometimes tripling the amount of times you're getting on stage a night, you're not trying hard enough. If you're getting into stand-up, just getting into it, and it's what you want to do forever and ever and ever and ever, and you only figure out how to get on stage twice a week, it's going to be tough.
Remember, from 98 to 2007, I had 2 addictions. It was just 2.
You used to keep a folder of how many times you got on stage.
Yes, I did.
And do you still have that fucking folder?
Yes, I do.
You set a number. I do. You set a weekly, a monthly, and a yearly number.
Yes, I did.
How many years did you do that? I remember, I remember that fucking notebook.
From 96 till today.
It was a weekly, month, and sometimes I remember you, to stick to it, you would be like, I got one more fucking set I got to do. I don't care if it's at a pizza place. I got to stand.
Doesn't matter.
I got to stand in front. You had one more, and you would make sure I stood doesn't in front matter. Of a fucking mic.
Doesn't matter.
I remember that fucking doesn't notebook. Matter.
It drove me crazy.
Yeah.
I was in fucking, I was in, just, I got to do 10 spots a week.
Yeah, I remember that.
In Denver, I worked my ass off to do 16 spots a month. And it would, I would drive to Cheyenne, Wyoming.
Gee. Yeah.
Like, this is 2 hours to do an open mic. I would kill it on Fridays, go up there early, get the shrimp and lobster sauce. They had some Chinese restaurant there. A bunch of New Yorkers in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Yes, I did. I would drive to Cheyenne, Fort Collins, Riverton, Wyoming to do the open mic. I would drive, bro.
Oh, I know, man.
I don't know what the fuck people are talking about. And then I got here. And once I got here, I knew that it was three spots a night.
Yeah.
Felipe's, another Mexican bar, and Rudy's. Then the comedy store. Rudy's. And that was it. And you know what? I forgot about my health. I mean, I was so into stand-up that health.
Oh, you had no balance.
No balance at all.
No balance at all.
There was no balance. No. It was. But here's the fucking crazy thing that you just reminded me. You know how many times I walked in the door? Because this was the process, just so people know. I would go to the comedy store, get a package, put it in my drug pocket.
From Chewy's hat?
It could be from anybody. And I would put it in my pocket, and it would stay there. Till I got off stage. As soon as I got off stage, I went right to the bathroom, did that first bump. I went to the bar, I drank a little bit, and once I felt the coke, I'd leave. I didn't want to get coked up in public too much.
No, that was never your thing.
So I'd go home, and let me tell you something. No, I'd stop, I'd get beers, 2 packs of Camels, 3 packs of Camels. I'd have a gram of coke. First thing I did before I walked in and did a line of coke or opened up a beer was I'd go piss. And then I go right for the notebook. And before I did that line of coke, as addicted as I was, I would write, Brave Bull did okay, got to work on that joke. The improv, I ate a bag of dicks.
I did the same.
And the comedy store, I did perfect. I just need to write this. I didn't like how I said that. And all had a date. How much time and what I got paid for each set.
I did the same fucking thing, man.
That was it. That was the first thing I did. When I got home, there was no calls. There was no cocaine. There was nothing. The first thing I did when I walked through that door, as much as I wanted to snort the coke, was open up that notebook and write exactly how I did, what I got paid, and what I tried and what died. And as honest and as brutally honest as can be.
You know what's funny is that I had one of those too. Where I would write down where I was, what I did, how much I got paid, how much time I did too. The other one I wrote down, so I didn't have a how many sets a week notebook. Because of the kids, I knew I didn't have that ability to get as many sets as I wanted. I kept track of phone calls that I made for myself, for my career. There were a certain amount of phone calls a day.
Every day. Emails,
a certain amount of some
calls,
sort of something out.
It's something.
I had to do something
to keep you busy
all day. Yep.
You work for yourself.
Yeah.
You are your own corporation.
That's it.
If you sit there in the daytime and watch TV or look at the computer, that's exactly what your career would
be. You're stealing money from yourself.
You're just stealing money from yourself.
Yeah.
That's why you have to have a schedule. You get up at 8, you have a breakfast, you go exercise, get it out of the way.
Yep.
Then you go to come home, wash your pussy, go right for an hour and a half. Then you go home because you can't sit there like a fucking...
I can't do it. I got to go somewhere and write. Yeah.
Then you go get a job from 12 to 8 selling fucking tape on the phone, whatever. And then from there, you get on your fucking car and you go start doing your spots. You get a little dinner in and you go do your spots. And, you know, I still remember that at the end of the notebook. Like, at the end of the notebook, it would be this last sheet. Would be what I made that year. So New Year's Eve, I'd get a gram of blow. Or I wouldn't. The night before New Year's, I'd get a gram of blow and add every month up. So I would add it up in the quarters. So January, February, March was a quarter. This is what I made. And I still remember looking at that paper and it'd be saying $8,000 for the year. $8,000 is what I made in comedy in 1996 for the year.
Yeah, man.
And I figured out how to do blow. Pay child support part-time, fucking buy clothes, you know, you figure out how to not buy underwear. I don't need underwear.
No.
I need six pairs of socks, five t-shirts.
Never wore underwear.
Never.
No.
It was like you just figured out what you needed to do what you wanted to do.
We used to So I had my bills on an alternate month payment. Not that the companies were okay with that. That's just how I paid my bills. I paid my bills like by which one was getting turned off that month. And that's the one that got paid. And the other ones that weren't getting turned off, I'll see you next month.
It's just so weird how you get addicted to this dream. And next thing you know, you're living in a house with eight guys on a couch, but you don't give a fuck.
Dude.
Because you're doing 22 spots a week. But you're eating ramen.
I know.
You're fucking selling cigars at a fucking phone company from 6 to 8. On Saturdays, you work a door because what's the difference? Nobody's giving you work on the weekends. You're just making money during the week.
Catering.
So, catering, yeah.
Lighting people's houses on fire.
Yeah, lighting the fucking set on fire like I did. It's so, you know, and you look at it and you go, well, maybe you were retarded for all those years. Like,
no.
Because I was telling Lee that after about 3 years, 4 years, one night, there does come a day that after 4 years, there's just one night. Because it's like a fighter or anybody else. We don't know what we're going to get. It could either be 200 punches before we start hearing people yelling, or it could be 4 punches. You never know what it is.
Yeah.
But there's that one night where you just pop your head up and you look around the room and go, what the fuck am I doing with my life?
Okay. So, two things. One, you know, there was a time when I was in the luxury apartments with the kids. I don't know if I told you this, but that my dad came in and had a serious talk with me. And he said, I really respect the fact that you're going after what you love and you're following your dreams. But at what point does that become selfish? You now have three kids. How long do they have to live like this? How long are you going to follow your dreams at their expense? And he said, I'm not telling you to quit. I would never tell you to quit. You know, we'll support you. But at what point is what you're doing selfish? And I was like, well, that is a really fucking great question. And to be honest with you, like I was going to do that one man show. And I was going to see what happened for 6 months or so. But he was right. At some point, I had to stop to prioritize the dream over the kids and what they were getting, right? But also, what I told my dad was, I don't mind them struggling. I want, as long as they see that we're still the fight, you know, we're fighting for what we want. But I'll tell you something, you know, that moment you're talking about where you lift your head up and you go, what the fuck am I doing here? That happened to me not 4 years in. That happened to me fucking 4 years ago. 4 years ago.
What happens every...
Yeah.
It happens every 3 years if you're normal. If you have any normality, you find yourself at the Comedy Store at 145. You got it. Because it never ends. See, it never ends.
Mm-mm.
You know, I can't imagine being Louis C.K. or Kevin Hart.
That sounds terrible, dude.
I just saw Tiffany Haddish in another movie.
I know.
So it's nice to be in demand, but there comes a point that you just lose yourself. And I have lost myself. And I don't ever want to go back there again.
Yeah.
There comes a point that you really lose yourself. And this, we've seen people, bro, lose it. We know people who've committed suicide. Like, remember, I was thinking about him the other day. The kid that used to put the handcuff on. In Seattle.
Oh, yeah.
And he killed himself. I mean, you know, I bumped into somebody the other day that I did comedy with 19 years ago. And, bro, it's not bad. It's PTSD from what this town did to him. He had a little bit of success. And then he couldn't cover the spread, which happens to a lot of people in this town. And he went away. And if you see him now, Johnny's room, you're like, oh, boy. This is no bueno. First of all,
it's one of the reasons I went last night, by the way.
Rudy Moreno is funny that. Rudy Sarzo once made a comment on him when I first had him on. And he goes, I don't know. He goes, I've been around comedians since Kennison and musicians. And he goes, you ever been in a room where it's a fine line between mental health and art? Mm-hmm. Like, there's a lot of comics I know that in the beginning, like in the beginning of comedy, those open mics could become dangerous. Like you're dealing with motherfuckers who still got a bracelet on from the fucking loony bin. You know what I'm saying? They still got a little breath. I remember being at an open mic in New York and some guy was like, I just got let out.
Yeah.
After 30 days, and I'm okay. And he had the bracelet on.
You remember that homeless clown that came on stage at the Underground?
Jesus, it never ended.
Yeah.
And you're looking at this going, maybe this is me, just from a different angle.
Mm-hmm.
this could be me.
Yeah.
You know, I always tell the story about the guy that would go up on stage every Monday. This is my impersonation of a bird.
That's my favorite story of all time.
Yeah. And he would just go up. He was very happy. He knew who he was.
Yeah.
He was like the character in The Godfather. You could put stickums all over the wall.
He didn't care.
He didn't care. He knew who he was. And he would go up on stage every Monday, number 7th.
Yeah.
He had a day job. He was happy as shit. He had 10 people that come see him every Monday.
This fucking guy was the best.
And he'd go up on stage and say, this is my impersonation of a bird. This is my impersonation of a shoe. This went on for fucking months. You know, and when you're a comic, like, you're like, okay, it's cute. You figure it out. He's not going nowhere. Like, you know it right away. Like, that's 96. I'm in comedy 5 years, and I'm like, this guy ain't awesome. He's not going anywhere, but it's okay. He ain't bothering nobody. But after a year and a half of listening to this every Monday, like, this is my impersonation of a man in traffic on the 5 in Seattle.
How often would he change him?
What do you mean?
Would he write new stuff?
Every week.
Yeah, he had new impersonations.
Tip-top Magoo.
Yeah.
He wouldn't impersonate nobody.
No.
Oh, he wouldn't do anything?
No. He would just go, this is my impersonation of a Boston Red Sox.
Yeah.
This is my
impersonation. That was it.
Of Jim Morrison at the Hollywood Bowl.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
This is my impersonation of a bird singing. So it's cute. At the beginning, you're like, no one is none of my business.
But whatever.
Maybe he doesn't
He's
have
having
dreams.
A good time.
He's having a great time. He had his little girlfriend would come or his little boyfriend. I don't know. Somebody would come and see him. But one night, you're in a bad mood. You just got out of jail. You know what I'm saying? Like, I just got out of county jail. I made the open mic. I'm happy I made the open mic. I know I'm going to eat. And all of a sudden, I'm walking past him. He's up there with that fucking, this is my impersonation. I'm a VW bug. And I don't know if it was me or somebody yelled.
You. That was you.
Why don't you do an impersonation of a comic and you could hear.
His whole body
cracked. His whole body. You could hear him go.
But it was what we had all been thinking for months. And he never came. Did he come back?
I think he didn't come back.
No,
I think he switched up to giggles.
What about. Okay, you know the impersonator up there that made me laugh the most was the guy who sounded like Jimmy Stewart. But he never did an impersonation of Jimmy Stewart. But every impersonation he did sounded like Jimmy Stewart doing an impersonation of somebody. But he never acknowledged it. So it was like, this is, you know, I can't do a Jimmy Stewart impersonation. But he'd say, this is my impersonation of Jack Nicholson. And it just sounded like Jimmy Stewart reading Jack Nicholson lines. And I talked to him after one of the shows. I go, you know, that's actually funny. You know, that's a whole different take on it. And he didn't
see it.
No, he was like, I don't think I sound like Jimmy Stewart. I'm like,
he doesn't see it. It's really rough to talk to comics at that level.
Yeah.
And explain to them what you see because they're so. I was the same way. People would come up to me and say, shit, I ain't going to fucking do that shit. It's so weird that I force myself to go to an open mic a few times a week now because I don't want to get over whatever with the Comedy Store, so I'd rather hide.
Yeah.
And every time I go, I think about, I'll sit there and watch the open micers. I go to the fourth wall and I'll sit there and watch them. And 10 minutes in, 8 minutes in, my mind goes back to being in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And what I was feeling at that time, like in 93, like, this is all I want to do. What the fuck am I driving a limo for?
I feel so lucky, dude, that I started in the Comedy Underground. I feel so lucky to have started in that scene. The Comedy Underground, the original Comedy Underground, is still my favorite stage ever.
Is it still there?
No, it's gone.
It's gone.
You get the earthquake.
But did it get replaced?
No. There's a new Comedy Underground, but it's not. It's nothing. It's not even close. It doesn't have. You know, there was so much history in that cellar, dude. And you remember you could smoke in there. So by the end of the late show, there was like a layer of smoke just on the top of the room. And it was just dirty and raw. But the energy in that place was fucking great. And I felt lucky starting there, like I said, because Carl was there to kind of guide all of us in the right direction. And it was a great fucking scene, man. I mean.
Carl was my first fucking Mitzi.
Yeah.
I was thinking of something the other day, Josh. When I called you, we were talking the other day. And I was thinking about one of my most ridiculous days of my life. Like, this is the most ridiculous day of my life. This had to be in the top 5. You leave Seattle. I get a job working for a company that sells advertising to pizza companies. and they're going to buy it into every, they cut a deal with the NFL. So on Sundays, when you're watching baseball or football or basketball, this is 1997. You moved here in 97, correct?
Yep.
This is 97, 96, because I came in 97. You were already here in 90. You came
September 96. Yeah, fall in 96.
You came September of 96, and maybe 3 weeks. I mean, I was lost without you. You left, and I was lost. I was staying with Carol. I was sleeping at fucking, because I was asking myself, where the fuck was I living? With the fucking cook.
Yeah.
With the cook.
Oh, shit. That's where you were living, huh?
I was staying with the cook. And that was great. That was like, yeah. You know what I think about? I think about Lee having to stay with that guy. Lee would have fucking gone home. Every night was something different. Either he was, the night I woke up and there was three black guys in the room smoking crack.
Yeah, I think I would have left.
I would have fucking died. I mean, what then was he his did name heroin. Again?
Lionel.
Lionel was one of the best young men.
He lives in New Hampshire. He reached out to me on Facebook.
Does he?
Yeah, I think New Hampshire or something like Vermont, New Hampshire, something like that. Yeah, man.
I would go there and spend a few days with him. Like, he was just great.
A great guy.
He's just a great guy.
Yeah,
he was a big part of my open mic funness.
Yeah.
Like, he made open mic so much fun. He'd cook you something. You were flat broke.
Yep.
And you'd walk in there, and he's like, I got some ham and turkey. I could whip you up a sandwich. You fucking were like, fuck yeah. And he'd sneak it to you. He was solid.
Yeah.
And then if you missed the bus back to Josh's, I could sleep in his house. And he lived in a loft. The windows were broken. It was freezing in there. You would sleep in there. It was fucking freezing in there.
Yeah.
So before you left, I get this. You leave, and this job opens up. $15 an hour. Full time. I was like the king in there. Nobody could sell like I could sell. I was calling on New York pizza parlors. What's going on? Where's Louie? It's Joe. What's going on?
Where's like, Louie?
I got this thing, you know? And I'm selling two or three an hour. I'm busting them. I get them up to 18 an hour after 2 weeks. I'm busting it. I'm living on the fucking streets. I'm taking showers downstairs. I think I even slept in the hallway one night downstairs. I need this job. If I could keep this job till December, I'd get the fuck out of here and move to L.A. And sure enough, Carol starts her fucking bullshit. You owe me money. Oh, all right, meet me downstairs at 5. It was a Friday. She was doing something, and I had a spot at the Underground. I was doing a guest spot for somebody at the Underground.
Mm-hmm.
She comes downstairs at 5. I get in the car with her. We go to the fucking bank, and she goes, I'm not giving you shit. And I go, Carol, don't start your fucking shit with me right now. And she goes, fuck you. And she rips the check at a car wash, at the Hurricane car wash.
Oh, yeah.
She ripped the check, and she fucking smacked me. And I grabbed her by the fucking hair like an animal that I was. And I just pulled the hair real fucking hard. And she's like, fuck you, I'm calling the cops. So I start fucking running, and there's a fucking, I mean, there are fucking helicopters. It's
Didn't you hide
crazy.
In the trash can?
So I hide in the trash can. The Hurricane.
It was a dumpster. The trash can makes it sound funnier.
It was a dumpster.
It was a tiny little trash can.
It was a dumpster.
Like Oscar the Grouch.
I jumped in the dumpster, and put the thing, and I sat in there with like a twig so I could get air. And bro, there was cops everywhere. I mean, it was crazy. I sat in that thing for close to 6 hours.
Who was that? Who was that big cop?
Rico.
And the big cop.
Upstairs, the Puerto Rican guy from New York.
Good dude.
And then I'm in this fucking garbage can 6 hours, stinking, eating old pizza in there. They threw like somebody's pizza was in there, like that didn't eat the whole pie. Like there was like three slices left. You bet your ass I was eating that pizza.
You ate dumpster pizza?
Oh, fuck yeah. I was in there for 6 fucking hours. It was in the box. I get out. I'm like, whew. I had like $6 on me. I'm like, I'm taking a bus to the Underground and I'll figure this out. And there was a movie theater there. It's where I saw Pulp Fiction. And as I'm walking up the hill, the cops are hiding in the bushes.
No.
They knew I was in the garbage can. They took their guns out, and they arrested me, and I spent the whole weekend in jail, and they dropped the charges on Friday. There was no charges.
Oh, because she dropped the charges.
She dropped the charges. Yeah. Some bullshit happened. But I sat in that. But the whole funny thing about it was that I jumped out of the garbage can, and I went into the Hurricane, and I called Rico. And I go, Rico, I'm going to fucking bind. Now, Rico was 6'6", 400 pounds, a black dude with a tattoo of a spider on his face designed with his beard.
Yeah, so he shaved his beard to it look like a spider.
A spider. And yeah. To top it off, he was Muslim. Yeah. I went with him to Montana one time, and this white diner, he got up and got on his knees and started praying. I'm like, Rico,
don't do
you're
going
to get a shot in fucking Montana. Rico was a nice guy. And I'm like, but he was telling me he was a criminal from the Bronx and all this shit. So I go, Rico, pick me up. I'm at the Hurricane. I go, Rico, pull up to the Hurricane. I'm at the door watching cops making patrols. I'm like, Rico, I'm at the... I hang up the phone. There's no cell phones in those days. No, Nobody had a fucking cell phone. I'm looking through, and I see Rico get out of his car, and he's waving in the middle of the street. I go, Rico, pull it up. And as he pulls up, something happened. That's when I went running. And as I'm running, the fucking cops came out with their fucking piece and arrested me. And I spent the weekend in jail. But I was in a dumpster from 5 to it had to be 11. I didn't make it to the jail till 3 in the morning to my fucking bunk bed.
And you smelled like dumpster.
And I had to wash a shower in there. It was a clean dumpster. The garbage was on one side. They had just picked it up.
Yeah, there Thank was God. Fresh pizza on the other
there
side.
There was fresh pizza
Aren't
on
you
the
listening
other side.
To the story?
I don't think it was fresh.
But then you go, man, this past weekend in Cleveland made me realize how fucking, also how fun comedy can be when you've worked hard. Do you know what I mean? Like, as much, it makes me, weekends like this weekend, you know who Jackie Fabulous is?
Yeah.
So she, there would have been years past where I would have been like, I'm not going to want her to open in front of me because I'm not going to want to follow that. But I found now that thing that you're saying, it doesn't matter who's in front of you. It just doesn't matter anymore.
I don't care if they like it. Nothing bothered me more when I was a feature act and headliners would complain about me.
Yeah.
It would bother me in a weird way.
Do your job.
It would bother me like there's a comic code and that's the comic code. If you don't like it, just switch positions. Just come in, be a man, and go, Joey, do me a favor. I can't follow you.
Hey, by the way, on the very first Blue Collar Comedy Tour, Jeff Foxworthy is far and away the most popular guy. The tour is being sold. You know, nobody knew who Cable Guy was and Bill Engvall and Ron White. They didn't know those guys. Those were by the ways. It was Foxworthy. And by the end of the tour, Foxworthy was like, Larry, you should close because what's happening is ridiculous. 20 minutes of him was just lighting the stage on fire, especially early on him. I know most people are like, fuck you. I'm telling you right now, you can laugh at and mock Larry the Cable Guy all you want. We counted one night, man, when I used to tour with him, dude had 367 punchlines in his set. 367 punchlines. And he would turn a set over every 18 months. It's pretty fucking prolific, man.
He also had writers.
He had writers.
Paid a lot
He had writers.
Damn fucking good writers.
Roger Rittenhouse is a great
writer. Damn good writers.
Did I ever tell you what Jacob said to Rittenhouse?
No.
Jacob didn't know. Rittenhouse has a hook. And Jacob walked up, and Roger and I were backstage talking, and Jacob was like 8 or 9. And he walks up, and he's eating chicken wings, and Roger's talking to me. Jacob takes a bite out of the chicken wing, and he goes, hey, what's with the hook? And I go, Jakey, and he goes, isn't this, is it Halloween? Like he, because the only time he'd ever seen a person with a hook, it was Halloween, you know?
Dog, he killed on stage.
So that funny. Remember that petting zoo joke he told?
He used to kill on stage when I started comedy. It's amazing that, no, I wish, I would love to hire a writer to help me. But here's the problem, the trust issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Like, the trust issue is big. Like, I would love to pay somebody every week to come out a few nights. But then I got to watch them and what the fuck they're doing.
Yeah, but what's so important for jokes for you is your voice is really specific. Really specific.
Right. No, that's why I can't do it.
Like, yeah.
I can't do it.
Because you would have to, I'm assuming if someone's writing jokes for you, you'd have to take the joke and then turn it into your voice.
Right. I would have to flip it anyway.
Yeah.
I would have to flip it a little bit anyway. It's tough.
You know, I've really, I know this is going to sound weird, but really almost stop. I tell pretty much exclusively long stories. You know, I tell some stories that are, there's a story that I tell that's 23 minutes long. But I've really stopped writing punchlines.
Well, the punchlines pop up with the story.
Yeah.
If the story is real and you're telling the truth.
Yeah.
And you know what? A story on stage, like, listen, I told a story about snorting coke with a cat, and we know we didn't look out windows together.
Yeah.
But that's a mild exaggeration to make it funny. That's part of it.
Well, you take the story and you heighten the reality.
Right. Yeah. I did give the cat coke. I did take a coke rock and he licked it and fucking ran away, and then a month later he came back and licked it again.
Yeah.
So it wasn't, that's what it was. I tell the story on stage that I was snorting coke with him. You gotta be fucking crazy if you think a cat was snorting coke.
Here's what I do is, like, I'll tell the story exactly how it happened for the first five times, just to see which part of the truth works and which part doesn't, right? But then sometimes if part of the truth doesn't work, and what's important to me is just to keep the intent, right? So, like, I used to tell a joke about Jacob challenging me to a fight, right? And that it happens to every, the premise of the joke is, like, every man at some point in time when they're growing up looks at their dad and thinks to themselves, oh, I could beat the fuck out of this dude, right? Everybody, you look at their dad or a mentor at least one time, like, well, I'm gonna beat the fuck out of this guy. So there was a part where I was talking about my dad and my brother, the first time I ever saw them fight. And the reality is, they were in the kitchen and my brother Dan kind of pushed my dad, and my dad pushed him really hard back. He picked him up under his underarms and just ran him into the refrigerator, right? So the intent for my dad was, yeah, you might be able to do that to me someday. Not today is not the day, right? That's his intent in the story. But the action of him picking him up and running him to the refrigerator wasn't funny enough. It was almost too real, right? So I had to cartoon it up a little bit to make it funny and almost less aggressive. You know what I'm saying? So, but the intent of my dad in the story is the same. I had to change how he delivered the message. And for me, I'm okay with messing with that stuff as long as I keep the core of the story the same, the intent of the story. You know what I'm saying? And so if the character has to change his action a little bit but keep the same intent so it doesn't change the story for you, I'm totally okay with that too. Does that make, you know what I'm saying?
No. That's the same thing. You tell a story to 23 minutes, I would wrap it around something and keep coming back to it. Because I don't want to hear nobody tell me a story for 23 minutes. I'll stab you in the fucking
neck. It's one story,
yeah.
But it's three different stories in the story. Yeah.
I can't have a 23. Like,
no.
My wife telling me a story.
Yeah,
no.
Yeah, it's three different stories in one.
No.
I tell the story about going to Desert Night that with the Stones and the Who and McCartney and Neil Young and Bob Dylan and Roger Waters. It's a story about going there for the weekend with my brothers. So there's a lot of stories. It's one story, but it's a lot of stories, you know? That, by the way, that weekend made me, I know this is going to sound so bizarre, made me really appreciate how good of a rock and roll band the Rolling Stones are, dude. I had never seen them live before. I'd only heard their records. And when they came out, after the first song, Danny's seen him a bunch. He goes, you're about to see the good Stones. He said, some Stones concerts, Keith doesn't fucking care and they don't care. He said, they're on fire. I was blown. I guess I had never, I know this is going to sound like heresy, but I had never given him credit. Like, I'm a Who guy over the Stones. I always had been. Not after that weekend.
No.
The
Stones are the Stones for a reason.
Oh, I couldn't fucking believe it.
Like, when you look at the Stones now, if you're Lee's age, you're like, look at these fucking old guys.
Yeah.
And look at what he's trying to do. You have to really look at the 73 to 78 Stones.
What albums are those? That's in Sticky Fingers?
That whole run they did. Sticky Fingers, Black and Blue, ending with Some Girls. Like, that was the result. Like, mm-hmm. I still remember the destruction Some Girls was. Like, I'm really surprised they didn't do a 40-year, because that's when they really were in the top of their game. Mm-hmm. Like, that, from, you know, Made in the Shade, that one where they went to Belgium or they went to Hyde to shoot the album because they owed the taxes in England.
Yeah.
Just then they went to Jamaica to do Black and Blue. Like, wouldn't that be great if there was a little fucking comedy club in Jamaica that you could say whatever the fuck you wanted to, and you go to Jamaica for 6 weeks and write an hour?
That would be great.
Take your friends down there, bring a bag of reef or blow, some chicks, and just get a house and write a new hour. Like, that's Kevin Hart type shit. Like, I'm going to Jamaica to smoke weed. That's what the Stones were doing musically. That's what people were doing then. Like, if you read the Aerosmith book, they would rent a house in Worcester.
Oh, dude, that Walk This Way was a great book.
That's a great book.
Great fucking book.
And, you know, like, they would all live in the house together.
Yeah.
They all did heroin.
Great book.
And Steve Perry and the other guy weren't talking.
It's my favorite rock and roll book.
That's my favorite book of all time.
Oh, that's a fucking great
book. They couldn't be in the same studio together.
That is a great book.
They were doing rocks. They were taping rocks. They couldn't be in the same. So he would go in the studio in the afternoon because he would stay up all night doing heroin. When he was on Rogan, there was never more of a podcast I wish I could have jumped
in. Who was on Rogan?
Joe Perry.
What?
About 2 or 3 years ago, I was on Rogan.
What?
And I was dying to call in and say, ask him where he got the heroin to shoot rocks. Because that's the heroin you want to do. Rocks is a brilliant fucking album. I remember one of the first.
Is that your favorite Aerosmith album?
No, Get Your Wings.
Yeah.
Get Your Wings, I think, is brilliant. And the first one ain't missing a meal either. They had a
string of four or five.
I remember one day I went off on Lee and you should have seen his face. Like, he had never heard that type of talk before.
About what?
Like, I was like, we were listening to, what were we listening to?
Was it Aerosmith?
Yeah, we listened to Aerosmith Rocks. And my daughter wasn't born yet. And Lee came over and I'm like, listen to this. And Lee's looking at me all confused. And I think after that talk, Lee went home. He's like, I don't know. Because I went off.
These are dirty Boston people.
Yeah. I went off.
Boston Celtics.
I go, you think of your struggle. Think about the fucking Aerosmith. Huh? You weren't just doing a Tuesday in Worcester. You were competing. The Celtics were good. The Red Sox were good. Mm-hmm. The fucking Bruins were good. You know. Everybody was good. The Patriots were like, Andre Tippett and whatever. But everybody else, you were, you know, it's either go see Aerosmith or go see the Celtics against anybody.
And?
Anybody. That's when they used to give 16 points at home.
There was actually.
They were just great.
There was a good music scene in Boston then, too.
There was a great music scene, but there was no Twitter.
No.
There was no Facebook. You know, when those five guys went on tour, like Black Sabbath in 75, They toured. They were opening for Sabbath. Can you imagine Rocks and Black Sabbath in 75?
That first album tanked. And then you've heard that story.
The first album tanked.
I think they said it sold something like a ridiculously low number. And then they went on tour. And they went back and they re-released the album with Dream On. And it blew up. Or maybe it blew up after they released their second album. I think that's what happened. It died a slow death. They toured, and they toured heavy. You know, they toured heavy. They did it old school.
Yeah, no, that's when you didn't get off the road. Well, you didn't get off the road because of the drugs. Listen, bro, Sabbath wrote, and, like, Sabbath wasn't off the road when they did Master Reality. Like, they did those in 8 hours. While on their way to San Francisco, we're going to stop in L.A. and lay an album down.
It's so bananas.
That whole lifestyle has changed. Yeah. Like, music has changed. Like, even comedy now. You shoot a special, and the next week you're on the road saying that material that you just shot the special for. So now when the people see the special, they've already seen that fucking material.
Yeah.
The agents don't. It's really weird. When I watched that Elvis documentary last week on HBO a couple of weeks ago, when the captain said that line, or the colonel.
Yeah.
He goes, he's fucking wasted. So now just get him out there until. Let's get as much as we can out of him. You're a piece of meat.
Yeah.
You're a piece of... This is what I try to explain to people. That this is why you have to stay grounded in all areas of life, because you're basically a piece of meat. And when you come to that reality, it's not a good reality for you.
Joe, I'm doing... I, you know, at my age and how long I've been in this town, the fact that I've just finally figured this out, but what you just said, it's why I'm doing what I'm doing for my career right now. I do things, I'm just doing things that I like.
I have a good time.
I'm doing things that I like. And like I said, I finally figured out what it is that I do well. And you know what I am? I it's kind of irreverent fun. It's a little silly, and I've really started to embrace it. And when, as I've started to embrace it, man, I'm more comfortable with who I am than I've ever been in my life.
Now I'm more comfortable on stage. I still got my anxiety attacks.
Yeah.
But I'm still...
It's why... Look, my Facebook fan page, and this is... I'm slowly turning it into a tiny little TV network. On Monday night, I have live programming at 7 p.m. On Tuesday night, I also have live programming at 7 p.m. It's two things that I just love to do.
You might as well do it.
And people are starting...
And it's your own little fucking
thing. Yeah, man.
And people pay attention.
You know it's that really Periscope crazy. Thing that you do? I do that... Basically, I call it High Live. And for an hour on my Facebook fan page at 7 o'clock on Mondays... We're just shooting the shit.
Listen, guys, they canceled Kevin Can Wait.
I know.
They canceled Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and they canceled The Mick, which the Fox stood behind.
Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
And somebody made a comment, and they said, you were getting 2 million viewers on Fox. What do you think you're going to do on HB, on NBC? The reality of that is... Joe Rogan gets 7 million to 10 million people downloading his podcast.
Unbelievable.
They get more than Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Mm-hmm.
So entertainment right now, it's coming at you from all over. Like right now, it's like a Subway sandwich. You get a sandwich for $2, whatever the fuck, what, $5 or something? Mm-hmm. It's like reefer now. Reefer is $800 a pound now. Sorry, there ain't no money in growing reefer.
No.
Because it's everywhere.
Yeah.
The abundance is high. It's.
But that's why the importance is, right? So you're never going to get that only three network number. You're never going to get
that. No, those days are done.
So what you have to do is, as an entertainer, and this is why, you know, it takes a long time to get this comfortable. You have to figure out who you are and do that and play to your niche. You're not playing to a third of the country anymore. You have to play to the people, which is what you've done, right? You've found the people that love you and are loyal to you and to what you're and who you are. And that's what it is. That's what entertainment is now. You're not ABC, who's only three networks, so I guess 40 million are going to watch because there's nothing else to watch. Your niche finds you now.
2 million.
And if you don't know who you are now, those are the people who are really floundering because there's no voice to pull people in. You have a very specific voice. It pulls people in. And so when you start to figure out who you are, you start to draw people in. And that's what that's why... The last year has been such a crazy growth for me, not just personally, but professionally, because I've finally started to, I'm not searching people out anymore. I'm just being who I am and they're finding me. There's a difference.
The hardest thing to fathom, and I tell people this all the time on Twitter, and they must look at me like I'm an asshole, like when they ask for advice. It's the most basic thing that they tell you here. You know what the most basic thing about this thing is? Be yourself.
Yeah.
That is the hardest thing to ever be in your life. Because you don't accept, you know, they're not going to like me. If I say I fucking don't like fucking alligators, somebody's going to be mad that somebody don't like you. Well, guess what? Somebody's always not going to like you. Even if you're perfect. Even if you're fucking perfect, people don't fucking like you. They're going to find a reason not to like you. So you might as well be happy and float your fucking boat. When they came to me and said, when Jamie Masada told me the first day I was here that I should move to Las Vegas, that I have no business being here, that I'm a cabaret comic, do you know what I felt like?
Like shit.
Death.
Yeah.
Death. Like a club owner to tell you that. I didn't listen. And now he sees me and he hugs me and I'm his buddy. I have nothing against him. I love him.
Yeah.
At least he was honest with me and didn't blow smoke up my ass like most comedy clubs did.
Uh-huh.
But it was the truth. Like, it was the truth, and you have to fucking find your voice, believe in it, stick to your guns, and tell everybody to go fuck themselves.
You know why else?
Look at Wheeler Walker. Look at Wheeler Walker. Now he's opening up for Kid Rock on the tour.
Yeah.
He didn't give a fuck.
No.
You do not give a fuck. You put your head down, you move forward, and you got a fireman's hat on.
But
2x4s are bouncing off your head. 2x6 14s are bouncing off your head. Joyces are bouncing off your head. That's just life. And you know what? You hope for the best, and you believe in yourself, and you always have the distinction that, I don't know, that you're not going home beat up.
That's the thing, though. Like, so what, for me, one of the scariest parts of being yourself is that, look, if you're not being truly authentic to you and somebody doesn't like you, it doesn't hurt as much. Doesn't hurt because you're like, well, that's not me. They're not saying no to me.
Fuck.
So when you put yourself out there, when you really put your authentic you out there, when someone doesn't like that, that's the scary part, because then they're saying, you know, oh, that's me they don't like. But after a while, you got to be like, you can't change who you are to try to placate other people. That's not a good way to go through life. You're going to fucking hate yourself.
I've sat next to people at restaurants and listened to their conversations. And I've done everything I can not to hold myself from going, listen, Baltis, knock it off. Just be yourself. You're not that guy, and you're definitely not that guy.
Yeah.
Just be yourself. What's with the cap inside and the fucking, what the fuck are you doing? You just wait, you know, how long is it going to take you to realize you're spinning your fucking wheels? Mm-hmm. That's what it was. Thank God that I had the Comedy Store like that, that I could just go up there and say whatever the fuck I wanted to. Because
she encouraged that.
That made me go into clubs and go, what are you talking about? Go fuck yourself. I remember one time I went to Houston, the other club. They paid me $1,500 for 5 shows.
Was that the one that dude used to own?
Yes, with the daughter.
Yeah.
And I went to that club, and the first night he wasn't there. The wife was there, and she came in. And she was like, oh, by the way, we work clean here. And I go, And she sat there and watched me from 10 feet away. And I had a bag of dicks. I mean, I had such a bag of dicks, like I was just embarrassed. And the next night I went in and I go, you know what? This fucking club don't mean dick compared to Mitzi Shore. I'm doing my thing. I ripped them apart. I remember I never went back because right in the front row, some chick, I could see her laughing. And then I could see her fucking left eye close. And then all of a sudden, I just seen her barf on the stage. That's how the show ended the first night. Her barfing on the stage, and it going everywhere, all over the stage. And she's barfing. The people around her are getting up and running. And she's just sitting there with barf on her shirt. And I'm like, I'll never fucking play here again.
Joe, this weekend at Hilarities, some dude was fingering his girlfriend in the second row. For the almost the entire Late Show Friday.
And you were watching it?
The whole time. And somebody was like, why didn't you say something? I was like, it gave me something different to look at. You know, I'm not used to seeing that. What am I? They're not bothering anybody. They weren't being disruptive. It wasn't loud.
What about in Columbus? A guy had a seizure from edibles. And Kate was on stage. And they had to come in with an ambulance. And they take the guy away. And the four guys are like, fuck them. We're not going on ambulance.
They didn't leave?
No, they stayed to watch me. Kate had a... It took 20 minutes for the ambulance to get into the building. I go, she's like, well, the club came out. I'm like, listen, it's going to take some time. You want to cancel the show? And I go, no. Let the ambulance go out there. Kate, go out there and do 8 hard and just bring me up. And it was perfect. And afterward, the guys came up to me like, fuck him. We told him not to eat that fucking edible. Thank you very much for coming on tonight.
Man. Always a pleasure,
a
man.
Fucking
thank
pleasure.
You so much.
You know, I'm headed to Providence tomorrow, so I'll see you motherfuckers in Providence. And that's it, and that's that. You got any dates you want to promote on here, my friend?
Yeah, I'm in at the Addison Improv this weekend, which is the 17th and 19th. And the weekend after that, over Memorial Day, I'm in San Francisco at Cobb's. I'll be there with my beautiful wife, Bethany. And then one night only in Houston, June 6th at the Improv, and I'm giving half of my money to Recovery Houston, so more people means more money for the charity, so come on out to that show.
Thank you, brother. You're a good man. Christ Killer, yes, Sycamore sir. Tavern tomorrow night, 8 o'clock.
Well, by the time this comes out, it was last night.
No, that was last night.
But if you're listening to this the day it comes out, I'll be at the Ontario Improv with the Smash Brothers tonight.
All right, look at you. You'll be at the Ontario Improv with the Smash Brothers tonight.
Hell yeah.
All right. Don't forget... You're looking for a fucking quality gi, Fujisports.com is the way to go. That works. They're big. The A5. Now I'm an A5. A couple more weeks, I'll be an A4, and I'll be ready to rock. I got a new gi. You know what I'm saying?
All right.
I love fucking Fuji stuff. They're the only gi I wear, whether it's a Superado or the fucking Sakai or just a plain one. They're my favorite gi. They're light. You can breathe. I bought a gi one time. It weighed like 82 fucking pounds. You move around, you're moving like fucking body armor. Fuck that shit. This is light, breathable. They got the thing in them so they don't stink. Hey, listen, I put my money on Fuji geese. Whether you're looking for shin straps, boxing gloves, mats, go to Fujisports.com right now and press in.
Church.
Bam! And get 10% off. Number two, you're looking for supplements? Fucking Alpha Brain gives you 100% money back guarantee, even if you don't want. Who does that? When you go to fucking Five Guys, if the burger sucks dick, do they give it back to you? Fuck no. Fuck no. Fuck no. If you eat it and say I got agita, they get no. No, they don't.
Eat it and get what?
Agita, heartburn.
Oh, I thought you said Hodgkin's. Nah, I'm like, I don't think you get Hodgkin's.
Nah. So fuck it. Anna got the Shroom Tech. Anna got the fucking Shroom Tech Sport. Anna got the Alpha Brain and the motherfucking protein. I can do you 10% off on that. The kettlebells, you're on your own. So go to Anna.com right now and press in.
Church.
Bam! And get 10% off delivered right to your motherfucking house. Have a great weekend. Uncle Joey loves you. Jersey, get ready. Dirty Providence, get ready. We're eating, motherfuckers. I'll see you this weekend. Stay black. Josh Wolf and my man fucking the Flying Jew, a.k.a. the Christ Killer. Have a good weekend.
Give up your vows.